Hi, welcome. This is Dave Kruger. I hear we have some early birds. How are you guys doing?
Hey, David.
Great. Is Carl here?
This is Carl.
Welcome. How are you doing?
Hey, doing well. How are you doing?
Great. Did you want to lead off and say anything, just before we get started?
You know, I'll just say a quick intro to you, and I'll just tell everybody about my awesome experience so far with Mr. Kruger.
Okay.
I won't take a whole hour. I know you're worth a whole hour to talk
about. Okay. I tell you what, let me say a couple of things before we officially start and you do the intro. I wanted to ask the participants, and first, I'm really honored to be collaborating with the faculty of New Vibe Training. We're going to have some fun, and I hope creative stimulation doing this together. I want to ask you just a brief question. If you'd say your name and where you're from. I know you guys are all from the Pacific Northwest, but if this seminar series were really successful for you, what would be the best experience you could walk away with?
That's a great question. Everybody write that down.
I'm one at a time now. I'm interested in your responses. Just off the cuff, what would be your best experience that you would hope for that we'd do together?
Well, Dave, this is Carol.
Hey,
and
welcome.
I'm in Portland, Oregon. I work at New Vibe.
Yeah.
What I would, if, yeah, less anxiety.
Okay. In your own money relationship or in working with clients, in what context?
My own money relationship.
Okay. Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. I appreciate it.
Welcome.
Super. Who else?
Carl, you want me to go? This is Madeline Rose, and I'm from Portland, Oregon.
Hey, Madeline. Thanks.
Hello. I think for me, I'm a real estate agent in Portland and have been for a long time, and am experiencing a lot of turbulence. And for me, I think it's just consistency and just better business decisions that I've made throughout the years. I've made a lot of money, lost a lot of money, done several other businesses, and
okay,
was in a bad partnership. And
uh-huh.
So I think to go to another level, just to operate
okay.
at a higher level.
Right. Thank you for your openness in sharing that, and I think that's a really excellent objective. Thank you. Who else?
My name's Donita. Donita,
okay.
I'm in the Dalles, Oregon. What my best experience would be is if I could learn to control my spending habits and be consistent about it. But I tend to not be very disciplined, and I need to be disciplined.
Okay. Let me right now refer you, because I won't be covering this in this bullet form. At my website, on my blog, there's one of the blogs that they're all archived on the right. It's called 14 Ways to Outsmart Your Brain to Spend Less. And that might be something that might be of benefit to you. My website is mentorpath.com. And you'll see the last tab on the right is blog. And you can go there, and the blogs are archived.
Okay.
Okay.
The other thing we'll
be talking about the whole aspect of behavior and mind and brain as it applies to relationship with money and money stories. So don't leave us now. Hang on. We'll be addressing that, okay? And thanks for that. That's an excellent objective. Thanks. Who else?
The other thing is that I work with a lot of people who are on public assistance. And so they have very little money, and they have a different type of relationship with money than I do. So learning
okay.
how to teach them would also be very helpful.
Okay. What kind of assistance did you say?
Public assistance, welfare.
Okay, got it. Yeah. Okay.
You don't have to leave.
Okay, thanks. Others? Any other objectives or hopes? Well, I'm so interested if you have any, and we can talk about that as we go along. And thanks for that feedback. It helps give me an orientation. Carl, you want to say anything to get us launched here?
Yeah, I just this is really exciting for the New Vibe, and just want to tell all the members here online that, met Dave probably maybe 2.5 months ago, took a class, and then we ended up offline having several conversations, and I'm just really excited to have him be a part of our community now, and going to learn a ton, because I did. I learned a ton the first time. I would also encourage you to purchase his book, The Secret Language of Money, if you have an opportunity. But I'm really excited, and Dave, I just thank you for being here, and you're the man, so let's go to work, huh?
Okay. All right. thanks, Carl. I appreciate it, and thanks for the kind words. I'm going to put us on lecture mode in just a moment. You should have two downloads, Your New Money Story Workbook, and then the seminar series outline, so you can follow more easily. In the outline for these four seminars, you'll notice that there's a corresponding workbook material in brackets below the title of each seminar. And I would encourage you, if you at all have time, to do the exercises and the work pages in the workbook. I think it'll give you a better idea of your own story and how you might coach others and see if there are things that are applicable. I'm also interested in your input for if there are things that you don't find there or things that you might want to add. I'm very interested in making this a very organic process. So I'm going to go on. And the recording for each of the seminars will be at that same page that Carol sent you, and where the downloads are, and they should be posted when Carol by the next day, the next morning, for example. Is that kind of the plan?
That would be great. Thank you.
Okay. All right. Super. All right. Well, welcome to the Art and Science of Coaching Money Mastery. I'm really excited about collaborating with you in this seminar series to talk about how to understand money, relationships, and revise money stories. What I'm going to do, and I'll take a vote later if you'd rather have a halftime break for clarifications or questions. I'm going to go through the entire seminar, and then we'll have some time at the end for discussion and questions and that sort of thing. In the first seminar, we'll talk about your relationship with money and the power of your money story. The remaining three seminars will look at the principles and practice of systematically changing that story. I've integrated information and research in psychology, neuroeconomics, behavioral economics, and quantum physics, along with strategic coaching. The synthesis is emotional economics, the study of the interaction of mind and brain on money behaviors and financial decisions. We're about to organize Mind Matters and Brain Business into the roadmap system. We're going to deal with that the last three seminars. The acronym, roadmap is the acronym for the 7-step process to understand your relationship with money and to change your money story. Then you'll learn how to write a new story for your own and your clients' greater success. We're going to combine, ideally, the art of fulfillment with the science of achievement. Now, although we'll discuss application to your money story, you'll see that the principles are fundamental to all change, growth, and success. My mission? To change the way you think, specifically to help you examine and understand your relationship with money and map new possibilities and choices to write a new money story. My hope? To guide you to look around the corner at the next years and decades of your life. What you do today can affect the quality and choices, perhaps even the longevity of those tomorrows. My stretch goal? To have this work together make a positive, powerful difference for you for the rest of your life. And as I mentioned, as we go through the seminars, I'd suggest that you actually do the exercises in the accompanying workbook. From Columbia University, we remember 2% of what we hear, 25% of what we see, and 90% of what we do. That's my suggestion. Put it into action. Let's first talk about your relationship with money. And most, you have an annotated outline, so you don't have to take notes, and you can kind of just follow along and reflect and you know, maybe jot down a little bit if you're interested, but you have an outline that has all the major bullet points. You're writing a story that you may not know how to tell. It's a very personal story with its own history and language. It's highly visible to others, but often not to yourself. It's a story that you talk about every day, think about several times a day, and it's remarkably simple, yet intricately complex. This story has an internal and an external dialogue, a secret language, encrypted messages. It's complicated because some important aspects are emotional, unspoken, even unconscious. This story is about the longest relationship you'll have in your life. Your parents discussed it before you arrived. People will deliberate it after you die. Maybe you'll get 10 years out of a car, maybe 50 with a spouse, but this story you can never stop writing or living. You can't break up with it, run away from it, or coax it into loving you more. Even though it's unexamined and elusive, you orient life decisions around it. When I spoke to an internationally well-known self-help guru, his response was, "You know, Dave, I don't know how to tell this story to myself in order to know what to change." That was the most succinct way I've ever heard it put. You alone determine the genre, fiction or nonfiction, tragedy or triumph. This story ghostwrites every aspect of a life story, from what you eat and drink to what you plan and play. Health, recreation, stress, even the water you drink are all impacted. At times, you may have used this story to regulate your moods, to adjust self-esteem, to influence others, maybe even soothe emotional pains. And I think this is so crucial. How you live this story will be what you teach your children, and of course now your clients. What they see in your behavior and hear even sense as your beliefs will be what they incorporate as their own. It's what they're unconsciously downloading while you're talking about other things. The villain or hero is the most popular legal substance to all peoples of the world. It speaks to you. You speak with it. And, of course, I'm talking about your money and your money story. Lauren Isley observed in The Unexpected Universe, "Reality has a way of hiding from even its most gifted observers." Let's consider two questions. And these are questions I'd suggest, if you haven't already, that you come back to and really answer for yourselves. They're in the outline. One, what's your money story? And two, what would you ideally like your money story to be? First, what is a money story? Your money story is not your income, expenses, assets, debt, or your net worth. It's your relationship with money, the plot and storylines of your money autobiography. Your money story is the secret language at work for you. It's the unconscious tale you continually tell yourself about what you say with money, what money means to you, what you think money says about you. It's a running dialogue about how much you think you deserve, how much you think you're worth, how much you believe you're capable of. It's also about what would happen if you had more or less. Let's consider some of the ways we speak with money. We speak first in a straightforward way. Money says whatever you tell it to. It can convey any message. The wonder of money is that it can represent anything. It's a stand-in for what we idealize and desire, yet fear and lack, for what we covet, crave, spurn, chase, or follow. We use money to show how much we care, or at times how little. We use it to measure success and to try to buy happiness. We may use it to bolster self-esteem, to regulate moods, influence others. In other words, we use money to communicate. We also speak with money as a tool. We give money meaning. We breathe life into it, give it emotional value, build a relationship with it, and make it bigger than it is. We use money to try to do so many things that are beyond the simple material value of money as a unit of We speak with money as a self-statement, and money can make any statement. What people say and do are inevitable, unavoidable self-statements of their beliefs and personal realities. All you say is about yourself. A life story or money story manifests through self-statements, and the story always tells most about the teller. Here are some examples of themes of those self-statements. A proclamation of freedom, a currency of caring, a promissory note for happiness, an embodiment of power, evidence of security, proof of worth, license for opportunity, instrument of control. For example, when we see a new car and want it, what we're actually doing is acting out our money story. Just below our consciousness, we're adding a new plot line to our money story that says, perhaps, this car is going to show what I'm worth. This will make people respect me. This will validate me. An obvious application is the self-statement of spending money. For example, conspicuous consumption is when you buy a red BMW convertible and drive it in the middle of a busy street. Contemptuous consumption is when you buy a red BMW convertible in the middle of a midlife crisis and drive it by your ex-wife's house. Now, by the way, that's not a self-statement. I'd never buy a convertible. Without realizing it, we use money every day to tell a story about ourselves and our lives. We speak with money, and we use money in self-talk. In other words, the messages that we tell ourselves. These internal beliefs, some of which may barely be conscious, and they can include people who have significant money are lucky. People with money are different from me. You have to work really hard to make money. Truly spiritual people don't have money or wealth. Money can really buy happiness. Money means the same to everyone. Let's consider this. We have both external and internal dialogues about our money and its use. For example, the external dialogue. Part of what keeps the language of money a secret is the fact that it remains largely unspoken. Our social conventions create unusual pairings of spoken and unspoken agreements. We can speak of a woman's dress size, but not her weight. We can discuss the cost of plastic surgery, but not age. We can debate financial markets and economics, but not personal income or debt. Ask the host of your dinner party, how much money do you make? You probably won't see the next dinner. Ask, what amount of debt do you have? You probably won't see dessert. Here's another example. This happened not too long ago. An agent at a writer's conference I was attending was discussing, this is a well-known, internationally known agent, was discussing working with her authors over the years. She talked about the details of some of her contract negotiations. Someone in the audience finally asked, would you talk about how much money's involved in the book deal so we can get an idea of what to expect? Everything had been talked about, essentially, except this. Well, she looked kind of shocked, and her immediate response was, well, I always felt that you don't talk about money. And she was looking as if she were trying to compose herself. There was an older gentleman in the back row. This was also not me, by the way, who said, well, I thought once you finished the book, you finally do talk about money. You shut down your computer, change out of those sweatpants, and start selling your book. Well, of course, he was right. His frankness in confrontation sparked a lively discussion about money and contracts. The presenter revealed the specific figures involved and went on to lead a discussion extremely useful to her audience interested in writing books for a living. A therapist, and I'm inserting this for Carl here because he knows where I'm going. A therapist once wrote, money questions will be treated by cultured people in the same manner as sexual matters, with the same inconsistency, prudishness, and hypocrisy. The year 1913. The therapist, Sigmund Freud. Almost a century later, most of us have learned to talk more easily about sex and all other matters, yet remain seclusive, embarrassed, or conflicted about certain aspects of our own money stories. And guess who had this seasoned, dynamic wisdom to say this? When we don't speak something, we make it more powerful. That was Harry Potter. Let's talk now about the internal dialogue. While we may not speak openly of something, our inner voice never gives up the conversation. We have dialogues in our minds before making a decision to exchange our money, our time, and energy for something else. Every exchange involves two asking prices, financial and emotional. The conversation, often silent and automatic, has many dialects. Let me give you some examples. It was the debate I had with myself in my first official job. At age 8, I earned 10 cents a row chopping cotton from my dad on hot summer days. Now, you guys in the Pacific Northwest may have never seen a cotton stalk, but it's how your shirt got started. When I saw my classmates and when school started enjoying the sodas and candies they purchased, I immediately joined them. And then immediately, I wondered, you know, was that candy worth half a row of cotton? Will I get enough from this soft drink to pay one row of cotton shopping? I soon answered no to both questions. Family farms were below the radar of child labor laws. And my point here is that while we often even teach about the value of money and reasonable spending, we often don't look at the cost of money, and that's something that that we need to consider also as coaches, is what's the cost of money? A couple of other examples. At an elaborate birthday party, the parent unconsciously whispers, "I'll give you what I never had as a child." The preamble of spending may be to rationalize. Well, you know, this seems like a lot of money to spend on an HD big screen TV, but if I spread it out over the next 11 years, amortized, it only cost 42 cents a day. And then my wife said, "Dave, if you really want the TV, just go ahead." This is rationalized spending. Let me mention as a sidebar here, set alongside your notes page 8 from the outline, the ABCs of money mistakes and financial fallacies. I'm going to illustrate many of these throughout the seminars, and there's just a quick definition of each of the ones that that I think are very useful for us. Another couple of examples. We regard the same dollar differently depending on how it's obtained. Found money can be consumed frivolously. George Cassandra said, "This is found money. I got to blow it on a horse." Gifted money can be spent without debate. Salary money used after serious comparative choice. Savings or retirement money only with definite need or emergency. And consider, it's the same dollar. The dollar doesn't even know who owns it any more than war bonds knew about the war. This is a framing bias. Money is treated differently based on its context. And here's a quote from a documentary from a veteran of 3 bankruptcies on the verge of her 4th. "The high from shopping is still more powerful than the low from bankruptcy." Tilt. That poker player, we'll talk about that later. And the parent who says, "I spend so much time at work, when I'm off, I like to buy my child something to make up for it." A justification bias. Let's think now about how money speaks to us. A study was done in which volunteers had their brains scanned using fMRI, functional magnetic resonance imaging, kind of a video of the brain, when they tasted 5 Cabernet Sauvignon. Also a sidebar here. I have some elaborate mechanisms to get research from around the world, even correspond with some researchers and collaborate with a couple, but I can never find studies like this to volunteer for. So 5 Cabernet Sauvignon, the volunteers were told before the tasting the price of each of the 5 wines. They rated the wines. Now, as you might expect, they rated them according to price. The most expensive one they liked the best, and then on down, the least expensive one is last. And here's the zinger. Their brains corresponded. The area of their brains that encode the pleasantness of an experience, the medial orbital frontal cortex, was more active with the most expensive wine, and on down the line, exactly corresponding. Now, the volunteers tasted one wine with 5 different stories. They experienced more pleasure, and their brains registered it when they were in a more expensive story. Money sometimes communicates to us just below the level of our conscious awareness. Money speaks to us as confidants, one true metaphor that can stand for anything else. Now, let's talk about the quiz that you may have done in the workbook and review your answers. If you haven't done it, give your immediate single answer to these three questions. My current annual income is what? Blank. And put down your figure. In order to ensure happiness and contentment financially, with no more money problems or worries, my annual income would need to be what? What figure? And three, one word. What does money mean to me? First word you think of. Now, I've given this quiz to hundreds of people over the years, especially at seminars, just after an earlier book, Emotional Business, came out. In more than 9 of 10 cases, people's answers, and this was done confidentially and anonymously and all that, people's answers indicated that their annual income would need to be about twice their current level for them to feel happy and free from money worries. In other words, somebody who makes $50,000 a year believes it would take roughly $100,000 a year to be financially content. Somebody who makes $500,000 feels that it would need to be about $1 million a year to be worry-free. And in discussions with people after they take this little poll, there's a trailing double. In other words, if they've gone from 50 to 100,000, and when they thought that it would take double that, when they get to 100, they now think it'll take 200,000 for them to be happy and content. This emphasizes how more is not a goal, and how important it is to define what good enough is. There's no end point to wanting more. There's no limit to what you don't have. When you focus on more, on what you don't have, you ensure dissatisfaction. It's kind of like perfect. It's a goal that you can never reach. Even when you change the numbers, the story remains the same. The story in this case is, I need twice as much as I have to be happy. This is just one example of common story threads. There are dozens of others just as irrational and just as hypnotically compelling. Now, for a moment, look at your answer to the question, what's the one word money means to me what? And we're talking about money equations and how money can make any statement. Worth, autonomy, security, freedom, love, opportunity, power. A secret language becomes most developed by emotionally powerful desires. Unmet needs usually show up as symbolic wants. And a desire is not quieted by its satisfaction, and desires can be created by filling them. Marketers know this. Money is the legal tender of desires. Money becomes the ink blot of the Rorschach test. When our eyes look straight at it, there's only a design on paper. But when offered the chance to imbue the design with meaning, the interpretations will be as wishful and varied as each respondent fantasizes. People may think of their money as a reflection of their self-worth or their morals. One woman said, I don't know why money is getting the best of me. I have good morals. I shouldn't have money problems. Well, of course, money isn't related to morals. Action gets you money. Smart action gets you more. Efficiency keeps you money. Are there ethics? President Obama said, if you work hard in America, you shouldn't be poor. Well, you may work hard, but you may overspend, gamble, have 5 children, 3 of whom are college age, live in the Upper East Side of Manhattan, or have a shopping addiction, to name a few. A question. Who do you think in America has the best work ethic? Cast the broadest net of all cultures, groups, jobs. Who in America has the best work ethic? I've had guesses when I presented this live, and I'm not going to take this off mute because it's a little confusing. Guesses about shrimp boat workers being here in Houston, it would be sea captains there, farmers, immigrants. A number of really really good guesses. Ready for the answer? Heroin addicts. They get up every morning with a hustle. 7 days days a week, plus holidays, 365 days a year. They cannot let a single day go by without working. And it's not because their self-esteem will suffer. Here's how one heroin addict summarized it. If I don't get up early tomorrow morning and hustle all day, the next day I'll die. Now, I mention this to not confuse work ethic with performance ethic, especially with success ethic. We can return to this if you're interested, but think about how some people measure their success by work ethic. And I was at my desk for 8 hours. I did. I was on the job for 10 hours today. Performance ethic, success ethic. Now, why do we make these money errors? The more we give money meaning, the more we lose focus on what money really means. And then we do strange things with money. Intelligent people spend money they don't have. Sophisticated people get scammed, sometimes repeatedly. Reasonable people forego pleasure to pursue money in order to purchase back a portion of what they forfeited. Gifted people may not be able to convert their talent into sufficient income. Otherwise balanced individuals may spend extravagantly or hoard compulsively. Dependable people can ignore financial matters until they get really serious. Otherwise highly principled individuals can step over boundaries and write their own rules. I'm here in Houston, home of Enron, home of Stanford. Others are taught from the beginning. Burton Watson, CEO of Cybernet, conned investors out of $120 million. As a boy, Burton's mother would tell him, exceptionally wealthy and exceptionally intelligent people don't have to follow the rules. He listened to his mama. The messages will keep repeating themselves. People will keep writing the same money stories that imprison them until they're listened to and strategically changed. This is exactly where we come in as coaches. Another notion here, just to put the perspective in focus. Money has become more abstract. The vast majority of our money management occurs not through our hands, our broker's hands, but inside our minds in a complex interplay of thoughts, emotions, and neurological wiring. Here's a 22-second history of money, since you asked. First, two goats were exchanged for five bags of rice. Simple, straightforward. Then, coins enter as a symbol of value, a unit of exchange, which is, by the way, the definition of money, a unit of exchange. Coins were then replaced by paper bills, then paper checks, then plastic, then a pure abstraction of numbers stored and traded as configurations of electrons. As money becomes more abstracted, transactions are easier, but our understanding of money fades, and our relationship with it changes. Think of all the major scams in recent times. All involved abstractions of money, derivatives and derivatives of derivatives that the people say, well, it's proprietary, or I can't really explain it fully in a way that you can understand. Let's think now about the mind matters and brain business about money. What's the role of the mind and brain in money behaviors and financial decisions? The short answer, everything. So let's focus on the question, why do we resist change, even changing a story that doesn't work? What keeps people from doing what they know they need to do for themselves? And money is one of the three things that people know exactly what they need to do, but they don't do it. The other two are relationships and exercise, diet. Why will someone repeat behavior that doesn't work, often do it harder, you know, kind of like somebody who, you know, doesn't understand English, you repeat English louder as if louder is going to work, and expect a different result, even when it may lead to lower energy, to debt, to plateaued careers, or to disappointing relationships? Nassim Taleb asks in The Black Swan, what are our minds made for? It looks like we have the wrong user's manual. So part of the answer to why we resist change is in our minds. We repeat the same story because it's our comfort zone. It's secure and predictable. A comfort zone may be limiting or uncomfortable, but it's familiar. It's our default model. We repeat because we know how it's going to turn out. That can create the illusion of a effectiveness. A new story, on the other hand, generates uncertainty, trepidation. The easiest and fastest way to end this discomfort is to go back to the familiar, to the old story. People also fail to change because they don't feel safe changing. Changing means their home base of reality, the internal map that's synonymous with identity. Think about that when you help your clients navigate change. They're having to change their identity. It's a narcissistic injury to change because what they fashioned is the very best they could possibly do, and now they're learning there's something better. We tend to return to our default mode. Let's do a brief exercise. If you can, free up both hands. If you don't have a headset, tuck your phone between your chin and your shoulder. Put your palms together and interlock your fingers firmly so that your palms are tightly together, your fingers are interlocked firmly. Now, notice which thumb is on top. Now, keep your fingers exactly the same, but change so that the other thumb is on top. How does that feel? Kind of awkward, kind of goofy. Kind of log that in now, just before you do anything else. Now, move your thumbs back to their original place. Kind of a relief. That's the way things are supposed to be. That's why people don't change or succeed remarkably or derail when they do. They return to their comfort zone. And now, up the ante. Add significant success or significant stress, such as major transition, really out of a comfort zone. We're going to talk more about comfort zones and how to program change. There's always the pull of the old and the fear of the new. Now, the other part of the answer to why change is difficult is in our brains. The hypnotherapist, Milton Erickson, told a story from his childhood in which whenever it snowed, he would be the first to get up and go to school so that he could create a fresh path in the snow. He intentionally created a circuitous path with zigzags and indirect turns. He noticed that each person who followed him followed the same path. Until the end of the day, the path was well worn despite its circuitous route. No one started a new, more direct route. And he got increasingly diabolical with this. No matter how many twists and turns, each person always followed the path of least resistance. This is how neural pathways are laid down in the brain, by early experiences and then repeated until they're etched more firmly. And it becomes not, this is my story, this is just the way things are. Even if they don't work as well, even if they're circuitous and require way more work. To think creatively, new neural pathways must be developed outside the cycle of experience. Stimulation for new insight is a circumstance where the brain can't predict what will happen next. The catalyst for insight is a novel stimulus, new information, a new context, exactly what we do as coaches. We're going to talk about this juncture in particular, when your mind and brain both react to leaving the familiar and engage new behavior. The uncertainty of this newness can be read as evidence not to proceed, or even as intuition of a wrong choice. And the brain even has an error detection mechanism that will say, this is not right. Or it can be read and reframed as a signpost of change and progress, as validation of moving ahead. Discomfort and uncertainty begin any significant journey. Our brains even have, as I mentioned, an error detection mechanism located very close to the emotional center that says this isn't normal when we try something new. We're going to talk about how to use this mechanism as part of a powerful internal navigation system and its development. We struggle, each of us, to embrace change. And this is the zinger, and this is why we're needed as coaches. And this is one of our unique offerings as coaches. Many of the methods to facilitate change are contrary to how the mind and the brain work. Neuroscience, quantum physics, and strategic coaching have a lot to teach us about change and resistance to change. Our money stories tell us less about money and more about the human mind and its operations. At times, both our minds and our brains can work against us. When you think with one part of the brain and feel with another, you need a map. And each of you as coaches are cartographers. That's exactly what you do. We're going to incorporate some groundbreaking research from different disciplines with strategic coaching to understand resistance, to change, and guide strategies of change. We're going to use emotional economics to inform money decisions, even to outsmart our brains at times. We can reprogram our minds and rewire our brains to create wealth and success. And a final thing I want to mention before we stop, because I'm interested in our discussion and your ideas. How do we get our brains to work with us in creating money stories? The brain has a mind of its own, and we are of at least two or more minds. Neuroscientists study the responses and functioning of the brain by functional resonance in imaging, fMRIs, a video of the brain in action as it responds to different situations. These studies have disproven the long-standing assumption that people have a consistent and predictable set of preferences and responses that they choose based on logic. This is where behavioral economics came into play, the study of how people really make decisions rather than how they think they make decisions. Different parts of the brain operate in radically different ways. Money behavior and financial decisions are linked to both mind dynamics and brain activities. We're going to use these findings to inform certain decisions. Here's just a glimpse, a preliminary glimpse at some examples. The prefrontal cortex says, let's think about the 12-month game plan and about retirement savings. But the limbic system says, relax, let's have that cognac and order the 27-inch iMac. My amygdala even specifies the brand of cognac. It's kind of talented, actually. It can pair cognac with particular cigars. Now, back to the point here. Each part of the brain struggles over the same dollar, hopefully without pairing it. Emotions do not simply and only corrupt decision-making. Emotions narrow attention and compress focus on the immediate. But those individuals who feel no emotion are not good at decision-making. Making people happy is not simply giving them more of what they prefer or want. The brain's pleasure center quickly accommodates to new stimuli and expects it to consider. It's like being on an hedonic treadmill. More expensive toys means you just spend for more expensive toys because it takes more to register as fun. David Geffen said, anyone who believes that money makes you happy doesn't have money. And one final example. When someone's stock portfolio does well, they may impute this to their talent and smartness. And now it could be. Gamblers interpret good fortune as skill. And here's a confession and an illustration at the same time. My wife and I play heads-up poker, and she finally, after a long period of time of playing, like 2 years, she finally confessed that one of my tells is that when I happen to draw a really lucky hand, I have a slightly smug look that I look like I think I'm brilliant. Finally, she told me. The important thing about your money story is to discern what works and what doesn't. The components that don't work don't need fixing. The components that work don't need fixing. They may even be enhanced. The ones that don't work need to be revised in order to enhance both your money and your life stories, and to discern what's really about money and what hitchhikes on money. Your life can be changed significantly by changing your money story. Money's a magnifier. Like adversity, it reveals character. Whoever a person is, excess money will exaggerate. If a person's a problem drinker, money's going to make them more drunk. If someone's insecure, money will make them more paranoid. If someone's caring and generous, money can help them become a better philanthropist. The most fundamental understanding about our relationship with money is not a depth understanding of money or finances. It's about understanding how our minds and brain work, and how that affects our behavior, including about about money. The beliefs and decisions and seemingly inexplicable behavior involving money aren't about money at all. Money is a portal to the immaterial and the intangible. So we're beginning a journey to understand the choice architecture of your money story. You write your money story, live it, can revise it, or write an informed, powerful new money story. And remember what Thomas Leonard, the guy who started this whole business of coaching, said. After all, you just have to be one step ahead of your client. Okay, we're in discussion mode. I'm very interested in your impressions, your thoughts. You'll notice I refer to you throughout. I should have mentioned this at the beginning. I'm referring to you so that you're doing the work of this, and it's the same language you'll be using with your client. So there's a kind of parallel process here. Thoughts, questions, reflections, things you'd like us to talk more about?
So, Dave,
you got a lot of quiet people there. Sorry,
Dave.
I know I couldn't have been that clear, so somebody's got to have some questions.
Dave?
Yes.
Carl.
Yeah, please.
Now, in working with clients, you had said, making like the money connection, like money dynamics is connected to the brain and then kind of enhance what's working more. And so how would, like, the modalities come in, like solution focus, maybe positive psychology, maybe even a little bit of NLP, since you mentioned Milton Erickson, he was kind of a spearhead for NLP. How would these modalities help us in our conversation with our clients, like understanding these modalities and the topic of money?
That's a good question, and my response to that, and there may be different responses, and Carl, you may have some different ideas, and I'm interested in yours, because usually, having the answer drives the question, so I'll bet you have some good ideas about this. One way I think about it is that all of what we know, the aggregate of what we know, the plurality of our theories, informs our listening. It doesn't mean that we fit into or call up a particular theory at a particular time, but it informs our listening. And the workbook that you have, unless you want to really use that with a group or, it's really to kind of inform your thinking about that and inform how you listen to someone. So when you listen to someone, you're not going to be thinking about, oh, I'm going to pull this from NLP. Let me give you an example. Let me ask if those of you who have a little bit of background noise, if you'll do a *6 and mute, and remember when you're ready to talk, come back and do a *6 again if you don't have a headset. A couple of the most brilliant things I've ever said, I was lost because I forgot to unmute. So remember to unmute when you come back. One of my clients some time ago gave an example of this, and I think it really explains my best understanding of that question. He was, when we began to work together, a regionally known abstract expressionist. And there were some limitations that he had that were in his writing, his own success story. And as we worked together, in the course of time, he came to be an internationally known abstract expressionist. And what he did in explaining how he worked, he said, when I go to the canvas, I've had 18 years of formal training. I've had everything from line drawing to color to anatomy. And over 15 years, he had formal training. When he goes to the canvas, though, he emotes on the canvas. He gets in a state of mind that is a creative state, that he doesn't think about this slash means this or this color means this. He is in the experience of expressing it and doing his art. Now, when he comes away from the canvas, moves into a different state of mind, may include a bit of his left brain, he can explain it and understand it and talk about the theory and the structure of it, but he's there in that state of mind, it informs what he does, and it doesn't. It's not pulling something from anatomy or pulling something from line. It's just what he does. So I think we do the same thing in coaching. We have a wealth of experience, of training, of learning, and various kinds of intellectual stimulation and ongoing work, all of which inform our position of what we listen for and what we believe at this moment is most salient, and then how to present it or highlight to a client so that we can collaborate about it together. And that's the real essence, I think, of the coaching relationship, is that it's a collaborative one. It's a contingent conversation that what we say is based on what the client says. It's not us trying to get the client to fit into some Procrustean bed or some idea that we have or some program or set of exercises or something we have, but it's about having a meaningful conversation with a client that we're both focused on the client and the understanding of the client story and how to further the goal of reaching exactly what the client wants to do and creating strategies to do that. So I think we use all the things that Carl mentioned, and we hopefully have a number of things from, you mentioned NLP. I think that helps inform our empathic resonance with the client of understanding not only how they feel, but how they structure things, how they configure, how their mind works. There's an article on under my articles archives called Toward Brain Hardware Optimization that's about work and performance styles. And that might be interesting to look at how different work and performance styles will be useful for someone. There are many different aspects that inform our listening that we have been the contingent conversation to help the client understand more about their story and what's going to be in the collaborative mode to change that. Now, Carl, I'm interested in your thoughts about that very question you asked because it's a great one.
Well, I totally agree with you. It's a collaborative, meaningful, you know, it's definitely a conversation. And then pulling from all those components, so it's, I like that part, what you said about the, it informs our listening, informs our thinking. I think for us as coaches, it's so important that we just are constantly in a state like us being a student who wants to learn, and we're continually in class to learn more and more and more, and never take a break because, I mean, every client is so different, and you're going to be speaking to your client differently as well. So you got to have that bag of tricks, and so I really appreciate what you did say, so thank you.
Yeah, and coaching occurs, as you each know, within a relationship, and I think the best thing that we can do for each client is to spend a moment to get totally present before we begin with the client, because it's from that position of being totally grounded and fully present that we have access to all of our states of mind, all of the different experiences and states of mind, and it's from that place that we can best listen fully and that we can best use our intuition and have access to all the kinds of information that may be stored in different states of mind. And that, I think, is the very best that we can bring to a session, and that can be a position from which we listen fully and to preserve and protect that space so nothing interrupts that immersion together with a client.
Dave, I have one more question. I don't want to take up all time. I really want to hear from the others on the line, too. So I hope that everyone's gathering their great questions and asking Dave, who's a great resource here. Now, Dave, you said, and I didn't catch this fully, but you said money is connected to emotions. And what was the other part that you had said?
That, are you referring to when we make a decision about money, part of that decision is emotional and part is financial. We usually focus on the financial part and they take the emotional part for granted, but it's there too nonetheless, and it can override at times. Just like certain, you know, emotional, well, for example, making and spending money triggers the pleasure center of the brain, and it releases dopamine, much like when somebody takes a small hit of cocaine. And as an example, we'll talk much more about this later, but we traditionally have thought that when somebody does something and they win or excel at something, that creates the reward, and the reward is the payoff for that. Well, not so. When someone's brain is monitored, when they get to the point of setting down at a slot machine, that's when their dopamine spike occurs. That's when the pleasure, but it's the anticipation of the reward that creates the pleasure. It's making and spending money, anticipating a reward that creates the pleasure, which in understanding that, it makes it more understandable, for example, that people have long anticipated something they've looked forward to and saved and wanted all their life, and then suddenly they're not as excited about having it as they thought they were, or they have buyer's remorse and they can't figure out why it's not as exciting as they thought. Well, at that point, there's a shift to a whole other brain mechanism that takes over. That's the norepinephrine system. That's the long-distance runner. That's designed for the marathons, not the sprints. The dopamine is for the sprints, the high of the excitement that's short-term. So two totally different. Think about how that applies to your coaching clients. How many of your coaching clients have plateaued at about maybe a couple of months into the work with you, a month, 2 months, something around there? The initial excitement and all the exploration and the excitement of what's new, that's kind of plateaued, and they kind of begin to wonder, is that all there is? And they think, well, you know, I'm going to take a little break from this. There's two different mechanisms in the brain that can help you understand that so that you can continue to ladder achievements and goals and look at that not as an all or nothing. And I think it will make a difference about how successful your clients can be, sustain and enhance that success, and how much you can keep clients until they truly reach their goals rather than stopping for a reason that is not authentic in terms of what they really want. And Carl, does that make sense now in terms of...
Oh, that's so powerful. It's so true. You know, I see this in the coaching course here. 6 months, I see our students around the third or fourth month start to, what's next? I got to do this. And I get that. That's so true. That dopamine, how it's kicked in, and so maybe I need to hire you to help me to focus on the marathon and not the sprint with my students.
Well, you know, this also can save a call. You know, after you buy your BMW 535, you don't have to call me and tell me, wow, man, I'm disappointed. What's going on? You'll just know. You can enjoy the car.
Right. Exactly. So.
I saved a call.
Okay. Yeah. I need you, Dave. Great.
Other thoughts, questions, reflections on what we're talking about?
My name is Lynn.
Okay, Lynn, and then whoever else I didn't hear will be next. Go ahead, Lynn.
When you talked about the prefrontal cortex saying, I need this money for retirement, and the limbic system says, let's buy cognac and a television. When we're going through this, our money stories, because I just began coaches training with Carl, and, you know, I feel like I have a lot of work to do on my own before I can understand this money story with clients. You know, I'm my first client, is what I'm saying.
And you're your best coach, and that's part of the training, I think, is to really learn your own story and learn how to tell it in your voice to yourself so that you can best help others with their story found in their voice.
Right.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, that's exactly what I mean. And do you actually, when you do this and go through this course or this approach and you're changing your money story, does it actually have an effect on the limbic system, or does the prefrontal cortex become more powerful as you make decisions and look at your money? how you perceive and look at money.
Okay, I think I understand your question. The best decisions are balanced decisions, left brain versus right brain, emotional, intuitive, plus reason, logic, intellect. And whenever there's, say, an emotionally stimulating situation and the right brain kind of seizes and holds hostage the left brain, then that's a time to not make a decision, to, you know, let me think about it and get back to you is a decision, or to take a time out. We'll talk about that a little bit in terms of...
Okay.
The most important thing that I think we do with our professional and executive clients is to help them regulate states of mind. And I think that's the answer to your question, and it's a very important one, to manage emotions and regulate states of mind. That's the most important success strategy for essentially every professional and executive that I've dealt with.
Okay, and so my follow-up question to that, is there actual physical changes, plasticity changes in the brain as this left and right thing balances?
Yes, and we're going to talk about that specifically
terms
of things to know about the mind and the brain as we coach. So
okay.
Yes, and we're definitely going to talk about that some more because I think it makes a huge difference in what we do in coaching. There was one other question
okay.
I'll try to handle because I know we're out of time. Who else spoke at the same time?
Well, this is Madeline. It's not really a question. It's just a reflection of where I see in my career where I've just kind of plateaued, where I got knocked on my ass, you know, getting a divorce, having twins, and then the market shifted all within the matter of 1 year. And I kind of really, it's a weird place to be. Like, it's in this comfort zone that I really don't even like.
Uh-huh.
That's really not who I am.
Yeah, and that's the zinger about a comfort zone is that it doesn't mean it's comfortable. It just means that we've become accustomed to it, and the way that our minds and brains work is that we develop new wiring for what we're comfortable with, and it's an efficient way to do it. And then we get set in those ways, and it's a challenge to change. And this is exactly what we do as coaches, is to help someone understand that and strategize about best ways of doing that and best practices. Yeah, so thanks for mentioning that. I have a couple of clients who are Madoff victims, and their adjustment has been monumental because it truly wiped out life savings. And the person I've worked with the longest was very well known before that, is even more well known now and even more successful. So, you know, people change. And people create new stories. And it's exactly what we know and what we do as coaches. We focus on the choice architecture of this moment and what's next in coaching. Thank you all very much for your energy, for your participation. I look forward to picking up right here next time with you. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Bye now.
Thanks.
Enjoy.
Bye.
Goodbye now.
Bye.